Hey, welcome to this week's episode. Today we have Jimmy Soni joining us. Jimmy was the managing editor at the Huffington Post from January 2012 till 2014. He was a consultant at McKinsey. He was a speechwriter at the mayor of the District of Columbia. He's co-authored multiple pieces with in the HuffPo, Political, Business Insider, Adweek's, Atlantic Monthly. I mean, if I read you this guy's credentials, it's just going to make you feel bad about yourself because it makes me feel bad. Forbes, 30 under 30, Cranes, 40 under 40. I mean, Beta Beat, the guy's written a book already, and I don't even think he's cracked 30. He is on to his second book, which he is editing right now. And then on top of it, he's just a really cool, amazing guy. I got to know Jimmy a year or two back. He is a genius with publishing industry, how to think about digital media publishing, get your voice heard above all the noise. I reach out to him all the time for tips. You're going to love today's episode. He's a really interesting guy, tons to say. He is the author of Rome's Last Citizen, and his latest book, A Mind at Play, will be coming out probably in 6 months or so. But check out today's episode, filled with incredible information and just an incredible guy. Hope you like today's show. Thank you so much for listening. Welcome to this week's episode. We have Jimmy Soni here. Hey, Jimmy, how are you?
Hey, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm really excited to chat with you. You've got such an incredible source of information to pull from. I don't even actually know where to start, but I was, you know, we know each other personally, and I was checking out a website just to get a little more information. And dude, I didn't even realize, but like, I'm going to torture you a little bit here for a second. Beta Beat's most poachable talent, Politico magazine featured author, Forbes 30 under 30, Cranes 40 under 40. I mean, I'm just getting started on this list. Honestly, I mean, you're very young. Have you hit 30 yet?
I am 30 now. I hit the big 3-0 last August.
Okay. I mean, I know what I did before 30, and this would not be on the list. And I felt like I had a rather successful career. How did you get so much done in the short time post-college? You came out of college. Did you have a plan? Did you say to yourself, okay, here's the 10 ways that I'm going to set my career up, structure things so I can, you know, get my career at such a trajectory? Like, can you give us a little insight into how you got so much done in such a short period of time?
Well, that's a great and big question. I'll tackle it in pieces. The first thing I would say is, no, I definitely did not have a kind of grand plan for my career or for my life in media or writing or in business. Honestly, I imagine this is probably true for a lot of people listening as well. I felt then and still feel now like I'm kind of groping in the dark, right? And I'm just trying to find my way through. And I had that sense back when I graduated Duke and still have it now. I think I did do some things in college that at least gave me a sense of the kind of work I wanted to be doing and the kind of work I didn't want to be doing. And I always kind of have made, ever since I was a kid, just made really good use of time. I'm a hard worker and I push on the things I care about. But no, to answer the first question, I did not have a plan. There's still no plan. And, you know, there's a writer I admire who jokes that people look at his life with admiration, but if they were to actually see the stuffing, they might be a little bit scared, right? That it's like, that's it? That's the glamorous life you're living?
Yeah, I mean, you said groping in the dark. I mean, yeah. After hitting all of these milestones, I didn't even, you know, you're a partner at a major brass check as a media company. How do you describe that?
It's a creative consultancy and an advisory firm.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are tremendous with Ryan Holiday. You're an editor of The Observer. Do you still feel like you're groping around in the dark? I mean, there's no system in place now to just get success after success going.
I wish there was. And if somebody has a system, feel free to let me know about it on over email or on Twitter. I joke about it, but there are things now, obviously, that I know about what I'm good at, what I'm passionate about, and where those two things intersect that I didn't know when I first started my career. But to be honest with you, you know, I think part of if I had to kind of attribute the limited success I've had to anything, like I am really possessed by kind of new ideas and the kind of curiosities I have, I probably take just a few degrees further than everybody else, right? So I'll give you a small example, and it's the story of like how the first book, Rome's Last Citizen, which is a biography of an ancient Roman senator, how that came about. Because when most people meet me, they know my life at HuffPost, they know my life in media, a little bit of what I've done in business. And then they sort of get this curveball of, a book on an ancient Roman senator, where does that fit in at all, right?
You know, I was going to ask you that because I've always wondered that myself, right? Like, how did this get to be your very first book?
So there are two parts of the story. The first is sort of the before the idea ever came about. I've loved biographies ever since I was a little kid. I mean, if I had a choice, I was always reading a biography. I was always reading history. And so I kind of just was that was like the way my brain worked. The orientation I had was to think in historical terms and within history to think in kind of individuals' narratives. So I was always a fan. And then I honestly was just reading a biography of, I think it was Julius Caesar. And I kind of was reading about the Roman Republic and happened upon Cicero. So I bought a biography of Cicero. And then I found the name Cato. And I was like, well, okay, I'll just go on Amazon and buy a biography of Cato. And I went on Amazon, and it was just one of these things. Like I ran a search, didn't see anything, and I just became obsessed with this idea. Like it was genuinely just a sort of sense that there was some great historical injustice in there not being a biography for Cato. So it wasn't like I spent 10 years studying Roman history and then got a PhD and all the rest. I just went on Amazon, didn't see something, and decided to fill that particular hole in the market. And so in a way, it's almost classically entrepreneurial more than it is like authorial, right? Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't like I didn't go to the Iowa Writers Workshop. I didn't, pound the pavement, write short stories. I just saw something that needed to be done because I knew in my bones that Cato was an interesting enough figure to deserve, 300 to 400 pages. And I figured, why not me? And then that's the kind of pre-story. The story itself is really simple, which is the way I thought about it was that writing a book proposal, which for nonfiction authors is the way that you get a book deal, that was such a low investment of my time and resources because I could do it alongside other things. And if the proposal went somewhere, great. That would be an amazing, like once in a lifetime chance. If the proposal didn't go anywhere, all I did was spend some of my evenings and weekends working on a proposal. I wasn't sinking, I wasn't like exhausting my savings account to write the draft of the book and then see if it goes anywhere. And then hopefully that something happens or else I end up on the street. I think I took a very calculated gamble, which was I could spend time after work and on the weekends writing a very good book proposal and seeing if it goes anywhere. And I was fortunate that it did. But that, that story, which can seem on the outside like, oh my God, that must have been such a Herculean, risky, crazy adventure. It's actually much more practical than that. I just found something that wasn't done, decided to take a small bet on a proposal, and the proposal was bought, and then I wrote the book. And that's the story of that book. And I think it illustrates what I was saying earlier, just about the idea that, I followed that curiosity about this guy, Cato, probably 2 or 3 degrees further than somebody else.
And would you say that that's a process that you institute on a regular basis where you go out, you see that something isn't done, and you follow through with it, like in writing your articles and the various different other endeavors? Or was that specific to the book?
No, I think that by this point, with that one kind of lucky break, I sort of figured that process was pretty smart. So I, like a lot of people who are listening, like yourself, I'm a crazy list maker, right? So I have my list. It's literally a Google Doc called Articles to Write. And it's just an idea pops into my head for something I haven't seen. And I toss it in that Google Doc and it will get done eventually. I have a Google Doc called Books to Write. And that's it's at this point, it's 10 books deep where I know that there's a topic that needs a book that someone else hasn't written and it's going to go in the doc and I'll get to it. And then, there are other things like that. But for the most part, I think at this point, with my time in the industry, both media and publishing, I've gotten a good enough instinct for what will and won't fly. And so when I see something, I kind of know whether or not to put it in those Google Docs, because that to me is sacred space. If you're in the Google Doc, you're getting done. And so And so it was, you know, at the beginning, I think it was kind of a lark. I just didn't think that the proposal would go anywhere. I didn't quite know what the market was for a book on Roman history. I didn't know if anybody cared about this guy, Cato. But when I was able to sort of take a step back, I realized, you know, that follows a fairly natural progression. And I knew that the world needed that biography, and I was glad to be the one to do it. But I think at this point, I've got the process down where, as I'm kind of working through my days, if I think of something and I see that there's a gap, I'll just park it and then pursue it later. I think the difference, if there's any difference between me and the other people who are doing this kind of work, it's that I just pursue these oddball curiosities as far as they will possibly go before I give them up.
Let me ask you a question, because a lot of people have a sort of inverse process where they say, I'm just passionate. I'm not going to go check it out too much. And I'm going to write this book because it's a labor of love. And there's a lot of authors and, you know, even business people who do that, right? They sort of step out more from this heart space, and then they find out there's a rude awakening. Nobody wants the product. Nobody cares about the book. And they put years of their life into it. How do you handle that intersect between doing something that you're passionate about and making sure that it fits into the market?
That's a great, great question. And I'm not sure that it's an either or. I think I kind of seesaw between the two.
That's why I say intersect, right? Like, I know you don't do things simply because it'll sell.
Well, so the way I approach it is basically something along the lines of, I know that I'm passionate about writing, and I know that I'm passionate about history. So if the biggest circles on that Venn diagram for me are those two, and anything in that sort of middle space is fair game. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that it was going to be a labor of love as long as it was in the worlds of kind of writing history. And then there was a part of me that also knew that the reality of the publishing world is such that there are many millions of people with labors of love. Very few people get book deals. And so you have to be strategic about how you approach it. You have to think about things that entrepreneurs think about, like product market fit. And to my mind, it was a little bit of Googling and research that determined that, in fact, there were publishers who were publishing books about Roman history, that this was a sellable project, and that Cato was important enough and there was enough information about him that it could actually sell. And I think that was more of a kind of kicking the tires. I don't want to make it seem like this was an automatic process or something I had thought through. It was, honest to God, there were days when I was Googling how to write a book proposal. And like that, we're talking very, very beginnings of my life in writing. I mean, that's how honest I can be about it. I was literally Googling how to write a book proposal.
Sure. I was there at one point, right? Yeah. What are you going to do?
Yeah. And thank God we live in an era in which, you know, that's going to happen. But to get back to the question, kind of without veering too far off, I'm just constitutionally a person who is going to find a very practical way to pursue something I love or that I'm passionate about. And that might be a byproduct of the fact that, you know, I'm an immigrant, and we came when my parents moved to this country. We didn't grow up with a lot. And so you are constantly thinking about practicalities, right? It wasn't the case that if I went to my parents and said, hey, I'm going to move back in for a year, work on a novel, and it may or may not amount to anything. I mean, they would have looked at me like I was daft, right? Like what? Like, that's, you're not going to do that, because that's not how we do things.
Right, and right.
I think in a way, like its own way, it's a kind of privileged upbringing, because I am constantly thinking about the practicalities. And so I balance that with the seemingly impractical task about writing a book about Roman history without, you know, specific area or topical knowledge. I find a way to kind of weave those two things together. But, you know, I admire the people who are, I guess, just willing to throw their cap over the wall and know that they're going to find a way. I think I'm probably on this side of that spectrum, in the sense that I just will approach things with a little bit more sort of sense of like, okay, this could work or this could not. Now, that said, there are countless ideas I've had for books that my agent has literally just looked at me and said, you might want to work on some of the other projects you have.
But I love this idea. I mean, because I really think what often happens to a lot of people is they don't have those two pieces that you came into very young, that you knew you loved writing and you knew you loved history, right? And then after that, it was just about finding the right fit and maybe something that would work. I think a lot of people, it's a struggle to identify these core areas that they love, or they found them, but they can't think about how to make a living, or they worry about making a living. And so there's all these reasons that they don't get off the bench with it. So I think what you're saying in the arts, with somebody who is a writer, I check the box of the things I love, but then I go at it from a business perspective so that I can earn a living doing something that I love. It's really important.
I would say three things on this that come immediately to mind. One of my friends really likes to say that there are times when you need to write the book you have to write in order to write the book you want to write. And that's a really, I also knew that I wasn't abstract about it. Cato wasn't going to be my last book. And so I wanted any kind of entree into the world of writing and publishing. And then I knew that once I was in that world, I would do my damnedest to make it a success. And so there was a way in which I was like, okay, this isn't the book that I'm hanging my career on, but in a life in which I want to write many books, this is a very good first place for me to start. And so that was one thing is there are times when you need to do something in order to do the thing you want to do. The second thing I would say is I did not work on this project full time. I, in fact, was working full time when I started this project. I was actually working, of all places, at McKinsey, which is if there's any place that's as far from Roman history as you can get, it's McKinsey and Company, right? And so I actually used this as a way of kind of keeping my life in some proper order, right? I felt like I was spending a lot of time thinking about business and about analytics and about all these other things. And I really wanted to have a part of my life that was carved out for reading. But once you come home, that's really easy to give up. And so I felt like having this project, in addition to, you know, firing me up intellectually, was also just giving me a really good reason to stay consistent with my reading and my writing. And so that's one thing is I did this project on the side. And I, you know, a friend of mine likes to joke about how everybody now has a 9 to 5 and then you have a 5 to 9. And I think the only amendment that I would offer to that is, and then you can go 9 to midnight, right? So I was actually working on this book from, it was sort of the writing times that my co-author and I had set for ourselves were Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday from 8 p.m. to midnight, and then Saturdays and Sundays from noon to 6. And so for about the core writing happened over a year where we were writing 4 nights a week and big chunks of the weekend. And that meant skipping important personal things. It meant giving up a lot. But the truth is that was the only way to get it done and to manage to work during the day. And so I will say that I think part of it is just hustle and the amount that you want to do that. Like I gave up a lot of nights out with friends to finish that first book. But I'm proud of that effort. The final thing I would say is I was really blessed in having a great co-author, a friend of mine from college who was very close to me. And if people out there are thinking about writing a book, and if you're nervous about it, or if you're unsure, if you're not, you know, quite, you know, you don't know where you stand in the world, try to find a co-author. You know, companies are co-founded, books can be co-written. And my friend Rob Goodman and I have had a really wonderful partnership in putting the pieces of the books together. And he's a fabulous collaborator. And I think that, you know, it actually took a lot of the edge off because we were a team and we kept each other accountable. So if I told him I was going to be at his place on Tuesday night, then I was going to be at his place on Tuesday night.
Yeah. Great advice. All of them. And I got the opportunity to interview Tim Grawl. I know you know who he is. I don't know if you know him personally, but he's also in the world of publishing online and digital media. And you're another voice. I was so lucky to talk to you and Ryan Holiday early on in my process. Could you talk a little bit about sort of downstream from the book writing process and online publishing, you know, where you see things today, this changing market, digital media. And the thing that I think you're so incredible at is how to get above the fray. Like, how do you get your voice out there in what feels like such a saturated space with all the blogs and video blogs and YouTubes? And, yeah.
Well, I think there's a few different ways to think about it. The first is that, you know, the playing field has been leveled in a way it has never been. In human history. So, you know, it's become a kind of cliche to say this, but it's a cliche because it's so true and so kind of staggering, which is basically anybody can be their own publisher now, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of the people that you're interviewing have built their own audiences, their own email lists. They attract people who stay with them for a very long time. And that's a powerful thing that we did not have 20, even as soon, early as 10 or 20 years ago. What I would say is this, I think that what you're noticing online is a tendency among the big gatekeeper sites to kind of mimic each other, mimic styles of headlines, they mimic pieces, they mimic content. So in some cases, you'll see some posts on Medium that just live on like 5 or 10 different sites and you'll see them all in the same place, or you'll see the same piece in all of these different places. So what I would say is what that argues for if you're a creator or if you want to get a message out there is that creating new things actually has a lot of value right now. And that seems like almost stupidly simple, so I kind of want to unpack it a bit. But the basic idea is this. You can, if you're saying something counterintuitive, fresh, interesting, if you've got excellent reporting or excellent writing, the cream will rise. And that's different now than it used to be. You know, one of the things I love is Medium as a platform. So you'll see pieces on Medium that are written by people who have no platform, no name, but that are just so thoughtful or so personal or so revealing. And they will travel far and wide around the internet. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, like what that argues for is the quality of the work itself has come to matter more than where you publish or who you are or, you know, who's editing you or any of that, right? Those things still kind of matter at the margins. But one of the great things about kind of the open platform world is if you write something really thoughtful, people will pay attention to it and people will find their way to it because of kind of aggregators as well as social networks. And so, you know, what that means, I think, is what I tell clients and friends is less is more. Like, don't feel the need to publish every week. You've got to publish things that actually draw attention. And that means that those things should be thoughtful. They should be long. One of the things that I'm seeing in the work I do is long pieces are back in vogue, right? So anything that's like over 1,000 to 2,000 words, when you really put depth into it, these pieces take off because people feel like they're getting something that they're not seeing at the 10 other sites that, you know, hammer them over the head with content all day long.
Yeah.
And I think that the final thing I would say is like personal voice and having a really strong perspective matter more than ever, right? There's a reason why news, the joke is news is being kind of commodified, right? Or like commoditized. Like you're getting the same story about Syria, the same version of it from, you know, 10 different sites, which is why I think like you're seeing a really strong resurgence in op-ed journalism. You're seeing like people's individual personal essays go very, very far. And that's because those individual perspectives matter more because they're actually the only things we notice that don't look like everything else that's out there. And so that's hopefully somewhere in there are some useful kind of nuggets. I would really focus on saying something new, something counterintuitive. I would not be afraid to use the first person to speak about your own experiences. And I would try to think about length and depth and publishing somewhat infrequently, but really making a splash when you publish. And, you know, there's a reason that Warren Buffett and Bill Gates only write one letter a year, right? Because when those letters come out, people really pay attention. What can you say that's new, that's counterintuitive, that's fresh? Number two is how do you add your own kind of personal voice to it? Don't run away from using I and using the personal pronouns and telling your own story. And the third thing, I would think about length and depth and breadth. I would really try to kind of be as thoughtful as you can and to focus on, you know, somewhat long and frequent pieces. Those will get attention. I think that that's different now than it used to be. But you don't feel the need to kind of write every week just to draw an audience. I think people will come if the pieces are thoughtful. And then the final thing I would say is, you know, there is value in that kind of scarcity, that like a thoughtful piece that's long, that's, you know, not necessarily done every day, but where your audience knows that when you publish something, they ought to pay attention. That has a lot of power in it. And that has a power now that the internet didn't have 10 years ago, but we've become so saturated and so inundated with content that you really need to kind of craft a piece to make it have impact. One of my favorite writers online is Paul Graham. He writes essays on his own website about kind of startups and business and life. And, you know, Paul Graham is not writing every day. He's probably spending, you know, weeks, months on a single piece and then publishing it. And you can tell the moment that you read these pieces that they will be read 50 years from now by people starting businesses. Mm-hmm. And to my mind, I think that what's happened is you've seen such an increase in content that the only things that are going to stand out are things that reflect that kind of quality, that time, that attention. And so, you know, my encouragement for people would be don't fear the overwhelming tidal wave of content. Kind of use it as an opportunity to write things that are distinctive and to write things that are new. And you'll actually get more attention than you think you will.
Yeah, I think that's incredible advice because even in my own blog posts, I'm finding that weekly content, it's hard to develop a point that's helpful at a deeper level, right? Because in 800 words, it's so limited. And so you can only write something that stays superficial and maybe makes one point or, you know, a point and a half. But it's definitely hard to write those high value pieces.
I think the other thing is, if you're just surfing around, you don't have to take my word for it. Just surf around the sites that people spend their time on, and you'll notice that the top performing pieces are now starting to be the longer pieces. But I think length is always associated with authority. And I think now you're really seeing a lot of good long form writing and journalism get a lot of attention. And I for one, am grateful for that.
Yeah, I am too. I'm a big fan of this movement over. I love to hear you, because I know you study this and think about it all day long. So I had the sense of that. So I love to hear that you're concurring that that's what's happening out there.
And it doesn't necessarily mean that the economics of the media business are all that good. But for people listening who are individual writers or contributors, or even who want to start writing, I think it's a really hopeful thing, right? I don't mean to conflate the two, by the way. I don't mean to suggest that the media business is having it's a great time for us in the business, because it's honestly, it's not. But I do think that for people who want to put pen to paper, some of whom are going to be doing so for the first time, it's a great time to be doing this kind of writing and reflecting.
So, Jimmy, you've had this like awesome career. You've come out of the gate, like I said, so strong. You're coming up with another book right now. Can you talk a little bit about this next book and what was behind it, what your intentions were?
I'm happy to. It's actually another example, I think, of how projects can fall into your lap. So a friend of mine sent me for my birthday three books, and one of them was The Idea Factory by John Gertner, which is a wonderful book and a look at Bell Labs in the 20th century. So if you combined Apple, Uber, and Google, and you created them in the early 1900s as one company, that's about where Bell Labs was. And for the better part of the 20th century, Bell Labs was the most innovative. I mean, one of the biggest employers in the country. I think outside of the Defense Department, they were the biggest employer in the country. They invented, among other devices, laser, the fax machine, long distance phone calls. I mean, they did it all. And so he sent it to me, and he actually attached a little note that said, I don't think anybody has written a biography of one of the figures in here. His name is Claude Shannon, but you might consider it. And I'm pretty sure he just kind of did this as a joke. Like, he was sort of like, oh yeah, this is funny. I'll get Jimmy on some tangent. And I read the book, and I found Claude Shannon completely and totally fascinating. And most listeners haven't heard of him, I imagine, but he was maybe the most important 20th century mathematician that you've never heard of, because he was responsible for doing a lot of the mathematics that are the backbone of our digital economy. He just completed all of that math in the 1930s and the 1940s. And so he's this hugely important figure within the history of technology and science, but he's one of these people that just never sought out stardom. And so that's why he's not a household name. And so people put him on par in terms of the level of his intellect with Einstein and even, you know, with Tesla and others, but he just never got the recognition that I thought he deserved. And so I was talking about this with my agent, and my agent said, oh, I have the perfect editor for you. And it was a kind of classic New York moment, where she sets up a lunch at Michael's with an editor. And, you know, here I am, like, not really knowing what I'm doing. But she says, just come in and pitch this idea and any other ideas you have. And so I was sitting in front of a woman named Alice Mayhew, who is now my editor. She's at Simon & Schuster. And she's the editor to people who I admire, like Doris Kearns Goodwin and David Marinus. She, you know, has edited Walter Isaacson. She's his editor. And most importantly for this story, she was the editor for the book A Beautiful Mind. I think most people are probably more familiar with the movie than they are with the book, but it's a book about John Nash, the 20th century economist and mathematician. And so it's actually a good story, which is I pitched her the idea of the Shannon book. I was like, all right, Alice, you have this guy. He's a mathematician. Not a lot of people know about him. And then he does this work and it becomes really, really important later on. And he's kind of forgotten about. I said, you know, Alice, have you ever read A Beautiful Mind? And she laughed. And I said, Alice, why are you laughing? And she said, oh, Jimmy, I edited A Beautiful Mind, and it was shortlisted for the Pulitzer.
Oops.
Yeah, classic oops. Which goes to show, you really, no matter how much preparation you have, you're always going to find yourself unprepared. So I apologized. And then I said, look, my model for this book, if I were able to do it, would be A Beautiful Mind. And I think that it'll have similar resonance because of who he was and the way he thought about the world. And so I was fortunate. She bought the book. Simon & Schuster is my new publisher. And I just turned in the draft about a month ago. I'm going through the first round of edits now. And, you know, I think for people who are interested in how geniuses think, this is going to be a really interesting read, because he's one of these people who had such an unusual mind, and he was so ahead of his time that it was almost scary. And, you know, people who enjoy books or movies about Alan Turing or about, you know, even Steve Jobs or John Nash or these other guys, I think they'll really enjoy this book. And the current title is A Mind at Play, which is in some ways symbolic of the fact that Claude Shannon was, he was a genius level mathematician, but he was also a juggler and a unicyclist. And, he played the casinos in Vegas and he did all these other things. But I'll come back on when it's out and we can talk about it some more.
Awesome. I can't wait to check out A Draft. I love those kinds of books. So, Jimmy, you've had this career. You've worked in digital media. You worked at the HuffPo. You've written two books. So, you know, the point of the podcast is this idea of having this really successful life on the outside, but how to navigate it, you know, personally and what that means to you. So I hit all my guests up with this. What does an authentic life mean to you?
Yeah. You know, I think this is one of the toughest questions. So there are two ways I'd answer it. The first is to say every day I wake up and I'm not sure I'm living an authentic life, which I think is part of living an authentic life for me, right? Is kind of persistent self-examination. And so, and I imagine that's true for your listeners and for your guests, that I still am racked with imposter syndrome, with a sense of, well, the ground will just sort of swallow me up as soon as everybody discovers that I have no business doing this work, et cetera. So I think that that's part of it, is like, in a way, waking up feeling inauthentic is part of my authentic life. Yeah. But then the other thing I would say is, for me, a deep curiosity is part of an authentic life. And so I am just like an idea omnivore, right? Like I am just hoovering up ideas left and right. And they combine in interesting ways. Sometimes they result in books and sometimes they result in articles and sometimes they result in projects and companies. But I think that for me, living authentically is kind of being really persistently curious and just having a sense that like there's always something new to learn. Like my friends like to joke that they're like, your brain is just hungry. Like it's like a hungry, like a toddler, like it needs to be fed or else it gets really fussy. And I think that's probably, though not the most generous description, I think it's probably the most accurate description of who I am, because I am genuinely somebody who, like, if I'm not stimulated by new ideas kind of every day, I start to not become a pleasant person to be around.
That's awesome. But I think that's such a, again, one of those big things of that self-awareness, that self-knowledge, right? And it's not right or wrong. Once you just know these things about yourself, then you carve your life out to represent that, and it makes for a happy life.
Yeah. And I also, you know, I think almost everybody who's in a creative field struggles with feelings of inauthenticity time and time again, right? Like, you know, every one of the writers I admire always felt like they were living in the shadows of an even bigger and better writer who they admired, right? Who felt like they were kind of not living authentically because they weren't, you know, the writer from a prior generation. And so I'm not sure that that's unique to me, but I do think it's a part of it, is I can define an authentic life as much as I want, but there are definitely days where I still wake up and I think, you know what, I really just ought to go and become a fireman because this just isn't working out. And I'd be so good at that. And, you know, so there are things like that that I think affect us all.
And it sounds to me like your path to authenticity then was really something that you've been working at. And I agree with you. It's more of a endless, you know, that's why I wrote the book about emotional workouts and emotional obesity, that it's something you work at all the time. So did you have a turning point moment? Was there ever a time in which your life was deeply inauthentic, or has it just been something you've been navigating since the get-go?
You know, I don't know that I can point to specific moments. I think one of the things that I think, if for people who are not born in the United States, if you come to this country at a particular point, that's a seminal moment that forces you to think about what it means to live authentically. Because part of the challenge about living authentically, if you're an immigrant, is you always have one foot in the old world and one foot in the new. And again, like that, it's largely sort of a cliche, and better writers than me have talked about it, but it's a very real feeling, right? So in my house, you know, my parents spoke Hindi, they didn't speak English. And so it's tough to think of yourself as like authentically a writer when most of the words you hear when you're young are not in the language that you're going to be writing in. And it's tough to think of yourself as somebody who's going to be involved in digital media when my parents had no sense of what that universe looks like. And so it was probably more of a series of moments, but I think they were kind of brought on by that sense of like the kind of immigrant upbringing is itself unique. I think that the other thing that it forces you to do is really be kind of, you have to be more insistent than your friends and neighbors about carving a life that you call your own, because it's very easy when you are in this country and you don't have any family around and, you know, your parents are working all the time. It's very easy to get sucked into a path that is kind of comfortable and that is safe and that doesn't have a lot of risk, because your parents are bearing a great deal of risk and you see what it does to them. Mm-hmm. And so you in some ways have to work doubly hard to try to say, no, you know what? Like, yes, I could go to medical school, but I could also do these other things that I actually want to do.
It's so funny that medical school is like the penultimate safe path, because I mean, my dad's a doctor. I have tons of friends that went down the path. It is like the hardest. I mean, you go to 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, residency. And I mean, my God.
I don't mean to knock it either. That wasn't a dig at doctors.
No, it's a wonderful profession. But to say it's the safe route, it's the hardest one out there, you know?
It's out there and it's getting harder. And the reason I mentioned it is just because, you know, my parents probably would have much preferred that I applied myself and went to medical school, despite having demonstrated zero interest in that. There's that old joke about the first Indian president, and he's at the podium at the swearing in at the Capitol steps, and his mom is there and his family's there. And he is on the steps and he's got his left hand on the Bible and he's got his right hand raised, and his mom is like beaming with pride, and she leans over to a senator and she whispers in the senator's ear, "You see that guy over there with his right hand raised? His brother's a doctor."
Look, I'm Jewish. It's the same thing.
It's the same joke.
So bad. I mean, it's like doctor or death. So when you're facing, like you said, imposter voices, like the world's going to swallow you up, like all these things that all of us deal with, right? It's life is stressful. Things are always happening. You know, the world tosses you in different directions. How do you stop yourself from making, you know, wildly inauthentic choices? What practices or habits do you have in place to help that process?
So I do a lot of reading, obviously, but a lot of very specific reading of biographies. And I read biographies of people I admire, you know, statesmen and politicians and writers and just interesting figures. And I think when you read as many biographies as I've read, a few themes emerge. One of those themes is all of those people dealt with these same things, all the same feelings of insecurity and authenticity, challenges, the difficulties, the personal disappointments, the professional disappointments. And so like I take a lot of solace in biography. And I think biography is my therapy, right? Like it's where I go to see that, no, I'm not especially crazy. I'm just as crazy as all these other people are.
And that helps a lot. I think that's a big piece of it, is we think we're alone and we're particularly screwed up. And so then we sort of dive deeper into it.
You know, there's a really wonderful biography by David McCullough. It's a biography of John Adams. And Adams he's a household name, a hugely important figure in the founding of America, but he's also massively insecure. And so reading that biography, like the parts that I was really like that thrilled me were the parts where he just didn't think he was up to the task of, oh, you know, founding a new country. Like when he goes through these feelings of like not sure if his relationship with Abigail is going to withstand the pressures of this, not sure if he's going to be able to keep everybody kind of on the same page, not sure if his presidency is going to be a success or failure, not sure if his political opponents are going to come after him and attack him and slander him and all this. I was like, the fact that someone so successful would have struggled with those same things, it seems kind of obvious, but it's not obvious until you read it. And until you see the difficulties that he had. And so I guess I find a lot of comfort in those moments when I'm struggling with these choices in biography. I would also say that there's a different format of that that I've really come to enjoy in recent years, which is I like long YouTube interviews with the creators I admire. So I don't know how many people do this. I'm sure many people do. But I spend an awful lot of time like watching interviews with writers I enjoy, because there's one moment or two throughout the interview where they'll get to like the process of writing and not the subject of the book. And that's when you discover that you're like, oh man, we are the same species, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's not like they wake up every day and are fired up and know exactly what to say. Like when you do these interviews and you catch these authors in their more honest moments, they tell you how screwed up their process is. They tell you they didn't think their proposals were going to get bought, that they didn't think they were going to make a life doing this. And so YouTube has been, for me, I know people use it in manifold ways, but for me, it's been a really useful way of calming myself down when I get self-doubt, because I watch these interviews over and over and over again. And I study them and I see, I'm like, all right, you know what? When he was X age, this bad thing happened and he's still recovered and you know, when he was doing this, that he didn't know if the book would work out or if the narrative would hold, and it worked out. So I spent a lot of time looking for those kinds of interviews. And then the final thing I would say is I try to spend some time every morning looking at kind of the day ahead and seeing if the activities that I have planned for that day are actually consistent with the work I want to do. And I'm not organized about this. This is not some, you know, great sort of Tony Robbins visualization thing. It's not that at all. It's much more like ham-fisted. Like, I just look at my Google Calendar. I see how my time's allocated. And if I start to see that the time's allocated in ways that I'm like not thrilled about, I just take a step back and say, okay, what are the course corrections I need to do here to fix this? And I would say that that's the very practical way. But all three of those, I think, are, you know, useful, and I've modified them. But those are the most useful ways I kind of, those are my stress tests for authenticity.
I love it, Jimmy. Thank you so much for sharing all this information. For people who are looking for this book, any idea roughly when it can is coming out?
You know, we're going on the back and forth on that now. It's either going to be the spring or summer of 2017, which is a ways away, but we've got this pesky little election in the middle, and that pushes non-election books back a bit.
Makes tons of sense. And I know you write for the New York Observer. You're always running articles. If people want to check out more about you, where can they find you?
Yeah, I mean, find me on, you know, my site, which is just my first and last name.com, just jimmysoney.com. You can check out Rome's Last Citizen. It's a nice little trip through ancient Rome. And you can find me on Twitter as well, though I'm not the most active on that platform. But, you know, email also works. I think I have some contact info on my site. I'm happy to help people navigate the waters. I've had a number of people who have done the same for me, so I'm always looking for ways to pay it forward.
Yeah, I can attest to that. You've been more than generous with me many times. Thank you, Jimmy, for coming on. It's been awesome chatting with you.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for having me.